Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Thursday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein, and we're welcoming listeners on KAWC in Yuma as well, carrying the show beginning this week. So hello, Yuma and Parker. Now, coming up today, we'll have reaction from Congress to the surprises that the BLM is moving out of Washington, and why is there not more information on that, plus the ultimate guide to the edible ingredients of the Sonoran Desert.
But we begin with the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, which has named the 7-member citizen committee tasked with evaluating candidates to replace Bill Montgomery as county attorney. Applications for the interim job are due on the 19th, and the committee will make its recommendations to the board on October 1st. The supervisors, though, ultimately get the final choice, whatever the committee says. Carmen Heredia, chief of Arizona operations at community health organization Valle del Sol, is among those who will consider Montgomery's potential successors. And she's here in studio with us now. Good morning, Carmen.
Good morning, Lynn.
So I want to start with the beginning here. How did you find yourself on this committee?
It's happening very fast. I received a call from Board Supervisor Steve Gallardo asking me if I could serve on this committee.
And what are you looking for in candidates as you sort of consider these applications that are starting to come in?
We're looking definitely for people with experience. There's a long list of applicants and people interested, and so I'm going to be looking for someone with a lot of experience and case history and fairness. I am glad that the committee is a diverse group of individuals that will hopefully be looking for the same thing. Someone that's interested in criminal justice reform and expanding diversion programs would be really great.
Carmen, this is a really important position, very influential position. I wonder if that comes into play for you. Would you prefer to have someone, even though it is going to be a politically elected position, is it someone you'd like to have at least for the short term, make it as non-political as possible?
Hopefully, Steve. That would be great. Someone that would take a very fair approach that would not make it political. If they choose to run, that's okay. We're open to that, I believe. We're just looking for someone that's going to have a very fair approach.
Obviously, though, this is a political process. This is a political position. Are there any sort of red flags that you're watching out for, things that you would really like to avoid, especially in an interim kind of capacity?
Well, at my organization, we serve a lot of individuals that are justice involved, juveniles and adults. We serve both victims of and offenders. And so I see the effect of trauma on that community. And so to me, someone that would have a fair hand and a good, fair approach to the community would be what we're looking for.
And are you hoping for a real team approach to it, I suppose, even though because so many of you are in a situation of not being able to, having not met before necessarily, and they're meeting in this, and as you said, it's a really short ramp up. So can there be chemistry among the members and actually discuss things? Are you expecting that from when you meet?
I hope so. I understand that Judge Chris Skelly is going to be our chair. We haven't met yet. It's all happening very fast. It's a really good, diverse group. And it's a tight turnaround. It's about 2 weeks, and we have to submit several names to the board, and the board will decide who they pick. So the more we can work together and jive, the better.
So looking at this as an interim position, obviously, are you hoping for someone who can be non-political just to serve in an interim capacity, or do you want somebody who is interested in running for the position and will be there potentially in a longer-term capacity?
It kind of depends on who gets picked. I really just really look for the interim position to be a fair, well-experienced person with a good approach.
So when it comes down to this, ultimately, there was a line that we all saw in the news release that the supervisors don't have to choose who the committee likes. Does that affect at all how you go about it? Does it make you feel freer to some extent? Does it make you feel like, well, there are different standards in terms of choosing? I guess, does it impact your thinking at all?
Oh, great question. I think we're going to focus on reviewing who we have in front of us and hoping that among that review, that really informs the Board of Supervisors.
All right. That is Carmen Heredia, Chief of Arizona Operations at Community Health Organization Valle del Sol, and one of the people named the 7-member citizen committee that will evaluate candidates to replace Bill Montgomery. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
U.S. House Democrats are headed for a showdown with leaders of the Bureau of Land Management over their plan to relocate hundreds of employees. The agency plans to move about 300 positions from Washington, D.C. to different states in the West. But how the plan came to be and how much it will cost is still unknown. KJZC's Brett Jaspers is here to give us the latest. Brett, good morning.
Hi.
So the name of the Bureau of Land Management pretty much tells you what it does, manages federal public land. Trump administration announced earlier this year it wants to move the BLM to Grand Junction, Colorado. But what are some of the details about this?
Well, the Interior Department is calling Grand Junction the new headquarters of the BLM. It's planning to move 27 positions to that city. And that's not actually a lot of jobs for Grand Junction, but other states will get jobs too. For example, almost 40 jobs are coming to Arizona. But yeah, Interior is saying that by having a headquarters in Grand Junction and moving hundreds of jobs out of Washington, D.C., that land management will be more local, closer to the people.
But like we mentioned in the introduction, some Democrats are opposed to this. Why?
Yes, they're very much opposed. So there was a hearing earlier this week in the House Natural Resources Committee. The chairman is Raul Grijalva of Tucson, of course. Grijalva was critical of the relocation. And one of his arguments is that the BLM hasn't provided any documents to the committee, any of the documents that the committee has asked for. So Grijalva is saying that, you know, we would like an assessment of, you know, why you came to this rationale to actually move the BLM to the West, to move so many jobs out of Washington, and also a cost-benefit analysis. That was one of the things that he was kept referring to.
So what can Representative Grijalva do about not having the documents?
You know, he told reporters after the hearing that he's considering subpoenaing the Interior Department to get the documents. The Trump administration has resisted subpoenas from other House committees on a wide variety of issues. So, you know, using a subpoena would likely lead to a long legal fight.
Okay, so what's Grijalva's actual ultimate argument against this relocation?
Against the relocation, yeah. Well, so he and other Democrats are saying that senior career people at the BLM will leave rather than relocate. So these are people that might push back against the politically appointed leadership of the agency. And recently, White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney said that federal employees moved out of Washington had left. Federal employees that were part of the USDA, for example, had quit. And he said that it's, quote, a wonderful way to streamline government.
Okay, so we heard from Democrats who know what Grijalva feels about this. What about Republicans? Paul Gosar is on the House Natural Resources Committee. He's not a wallflower. What did he have to say?
Right, Gosar, he's from Arizona, northern Arizona, and he's in favor of this move. Here's a cut of Gosar questioning acting BLM Director William Perry Penley.
And where are your resources located? East or west of the Mississippi?
Almost exclusively west of the Mississippi, 245 million acres of land, almost exclusively in the 11 western states and Alaska, sir.
So 99%, almost 99% of that jurisdiction is west of the Mississippi, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, see, the problem we're having here is that the swamp wants to keep centralized control over everything. Instead of what is best is politics that are driven locally.
Gosar told E&E News that no one is guaranteed a job, including federal workers.
So you reference William Perry Penley. He has been a real controversial choice to lead the BLM based on his background.
Right. He's the acting director of the BLM. He was controversial because he was at a conservative legal foundation for almost 30 years where he advocated for less federal control over public land. He wrote an opinion piece in 2016 where he said the founding fathers intended all federal land to be sold. Although in the meantime, he argues that, you know, now as a government official, he will follow orders.
KJZZ's Brett Jaspers, always following orders for us. Brett, thanks.
You're welcome.
Crime in this country has been on the decline since the 1990s, but findings from the Bureau of Justice Statistics National Crime Victimization Survey for the last few years may show that trend is reversing. The newest numbers from that report released this week show the number of violent crime victims has gone up by more than 600,000 since 2015. There's also a striking finding about the number of people who say they've been the victim of rape in this year's survey. It nearly doubled. For more on what this means and how significant the numbers might actually be, I spoke with Fordham University law professor John Pfaff, who studies criminal justice and sentencing. And we started by talking about what this survey is and how it's conducted. This is not the same as the FBI's crime data that's released every year. This is a survey.
Correct. So this is a survey of about 300,000 people that's conducted every year to try to get a sense of who has suffered violent or property criminal victimization. Our formal FBI numbers, they rely on people choosing to report it to the police or what's seen by the police. This is more a survey that's conducted by the Bureau of Justice Statistics and the Census Bureau to really ask people, what have you suffered, even if you didn't report it to the police?
And the headline that's kind of coming from this report being released this year is that this longtime trend of crime going down in the country is maybe being reversed. What do you make of that?
So it's true that we've seen an increase in this victim survey over the past 3 years. It's also worth noting that it's still well below where it was in the 90s. Now, in the 90s, it's around 3 to 4% of all people were being victimized. Now it's barely above 1%, right? And it's still down that low. It's also worth noting that it went up from 2010 to 2012 and then dropped to 2015. It's gone up again. You know, this increase is less than that previous increase. No, it's these numbers move around, and we don't want to ignore the trend, but this is by no means a sign yet that sort of this great crime decline is at its end.
Do you think that there's a reason that that is the way this is being interpreted?
I think as much as Donald Trump has tried to, you know, take credit for the First Step Act and really made that something he refers to a lot, sort of the big federal criminal justice reform bill, a lot of his rhetoric, his political rhetoric, is very much rooted in a tough on crime frame. And I think, you know, this reflects the administration's desire to advance relatively harsh policies and to push back against the sort of the burgeoning criminal justice reform movement.
And one area that shows a statistically significant rise in this report and that's getting a lot of attention here is in the number of rapes reported. So that number nearly doubled from 2017 to 2018. What do you make of that particular stat and all of the attention it's getting?
It's a tricky statistic to interpret. It's gone up dramatically. There's no other offense to look at this year that rose in that magnitude. If it's something real, that's definitely something concerning that we need to pay attention to. But, you know, a jump of this increase is oftentimes surprising, especially surprising even we didn't hear any real issues about it during the year, right? Like, you know, you didn't hear complaints that by the police and other agencies that rapes are going way up. And so it's surprising to suddenly see it in the numbers. It is possible that there are other interpretations, right? It could be, you know, one possibility, for example, is, you know, rape is well known to be underreported to police. This is designed to get around that problem, this survey. But it could be that, you know, one thing that's come in the wake of the Me Too movement is that women are even more willing to talk to interviewers about sexual abuse, or might even view incidents that they might dismiss as just sort of, oh, men being men. They now realize, no, this was sexual assault. This was rape. And so there could be something more than just a change in victimization, more a change in willingness to talk about it, or a change in awareness that victimization really took place.
Right, right. A lot of this conversation is crediting this to the Me Too movement and an increased willingness of women to report harassment. So to you, this is not necessarily a marker that actual rapes in this country have doubled, but it could be more about reporting.
Yes, it definitely could be. I mean, there could be something real here. There could be, or it could be both, right? There could be a real increase, but a chunk of it is also reporting. It's important not to just dismiss this as nothing more than probably reporting error. There's something we definitely want to pay attention to, but it's also far too soon to say that what we really experienced was a true near doubling in rapes in a single year.
What else would you want to see in order to prove the trend, I guess, in order to believe that this is more prevalent than we used to think?
I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens when the official uniform crime reports come out at the end of the month, right, to see if there's something similar in that numbers. You know, they're not measuring the exact same thing, but they do inform each other. You know, I think also it'll take some digging to really try to, you know, talk more with rape crisis centers and police departments to try to get a sense of what they really experienced over 2018 and try to get a sense of what's going on here. I think the numbers alone can't tell us. I think we need some more sort of investigative digging to see what happened here.
John Pfaff is a professor of law at Fordham University in New York. John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Former Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller's congressional testimony earlier this summer reasserted and cemented what had already been known. Russia has been working to affect U.S. elections by hacking into databases and seeking to sow disagreements in multiple ways on social media. That has served to make it even clearer that the nation needs to be emphasizing improvement on cybersecurity. That's at the core of former White House counterterrorism coordinator Richard Clark's new book, The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats. And he is with us. Richard, at the government level, do most people understand this should be a major concern?
I think most members of Congress understand that Russia, China, Iran, North Korea,
are hacking American companies and government agencies. And they agree on most things. When it comes to giving money to the states and the counties to defend themselves on the elections and the cybersecurity of elections, there's a disagreement, and it is partisan. The Republican leader in the Senate is holding up money that would help the states and counties defend themselves. But I think when it comes to giving money to the Pentagon to wage offensive cyber war and to defend the Pentagon, there's bipartisan agreement.
Measure for me, if you would, where offense versus defense in the literal sense really comes from on this. Does there need to be a strong commitment to both offense and defense, to be willing to be aggressive against adversaries or be more in the position of just protecting ourselves from them?
Well, having an offensive capability is good, but it may not deter the other guy from attacking you. If Russia attacks us and turns out all the lights in the United States, the fact that we can do that to them won't get your lights back on. You really need to have a defensive capability. And until recently, the defense has been almost impossible to do. The offensive technologies were much more efficient, much more capable. This has changed. There are new defensive technologies which, taken together and played in unison, can now defend American companies. And while you hear about Target and Equifax and Yahoo and Marriott having been hacked, there are a whole bunch of companies you don't hear about because they have not been successfully attacked, because they know how to do it.
Let's talk about Silicon Valley. In order to make this as effective as possible from a defense standpoint, does there have to be a feeling where government is working well with private business? Can they do it on separate tracks and come together on certain things? How do you see that?
Private companies coming out of Silicon Valley essentially run cyberspace. More and more, everything is in the cloud. And the cloud is either run by Amazon or Microsoft or, to some extent, other companies like Oracle. And the technologies that successfully defend against cyber attacks all are private companies. When I say there are new technologies that you can successfully defend yourself with, it's not one. You got to string together, in some cases, 50 or 60 different applications, hardware and software, to defend yourself. You've got to integrate all of that. And the government can't do that. The government doesn't invent any of this stuff anymore. It has to buy commercial, and so it has to rely on private sector support.
How nasty is all this potentially? And it's already been very nasty, I get that. Is this something that has the capability of blowing things up in a way that, the world has never seen and cause more damage than the world has ever seen?
Well, every day we are suffering from cyber attacks. And if there ever were a war between nation states that have cyber armies, and most of the big countries do now, we would see attacks going into the countries, not just on the battlefield, but going into the homeland on both sides, and causing damage to things like railroads and airports, as well as banks and traffic lights, and really disrupting the economies in ways that have never happened before.
So at the core, what is Russia's motivation for getting involved in our elections, potentially trying to take down the power grid? Is this about the Obama administration and Secretary Clinton at the time going after them hard? Is it just a matter of sort of trying to reassess themselves as a superpower? How does this all happen? Because it doesn't feel as though attacking the U.S. or other nations is going to lift Russia up. It almost feels like they're trying to bring the U.S. down to its level to some extent.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, Putin feels personally aggrieved. He grew up in the Soviet Union. It was a superpower. It doesn't exist anymore. It's broken up into a dozen countries. They're now a relatively small and poor country. But they still have a military. They still have an intelligence service that's pretty good. And so he wants to break up the European Union. He wants to break up the NATO alliance. He wants to do things in our own country that put us at each other's throats. And so his intelligence service gets online in places like Facebook and Twitter and takes both sides of an issue, just trying to cause us to be more divisive as a nation, more inwardly focused, so that we can't confront them. so that we can't stop them from doing the kind of subversion that they are doing on countries in their periphery. I also think there's just a certain sense of revenge that Putin's going out after. And it makes him and some people in Russia feel bigger and better that they can cause this kind of disruption to a nation that they think is pretty arrogant.
Richard Clark is co-author of the new book, The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats. Richard, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
The U.S. military is looking to use artificial intelligence to help pilots. Initial iterations of Skyborg have been tested in Yuma, and officials hope to eventually be able to produce the drones for a few million dollars each. To talk more about what this means for both the military and AI in general, our co-host Mark Brody spoke via Skype with Peter Singer. He's a strategist at New America and a professor of practice at ASU's Center for the Future of War.
What is this all about? What's the purpose of this?
So what the Air Force is working on is the next generation of unmanned aerial systems, popularly known as drones. And one of the visions of them is that they could operate as almost like robotic wingmen for fighter and bomber planes, so that you would have the man plane flying out there and then flying alongside it, maybe doing missions for it, would be an unmanned jet fighter size plane.
What is the goal of having artificial intelligence involved with this? Like, what does that do for the Air Force that just maybe a regular remote-controlled unmanned drone might have?
So there's a couple of things going on here. The first is the idea that you could task out that robotic plane to take on some part of the mission that might be too complex, too dangerous in particular for a human wingman. The other thing that's happening is an issue of financial cost. To put it bluntly, the Air Force budget isn't big enough to buy all the manned fighter planes that it wants. And so it's looking to cheaper unmanned alternatives as a way of kind of bulking out the force.
I wonder, given the unpredictability of war and combat, if it might be more difficult for an AI system to sort of learn what the quote-unquote right thing to do is, as opposed to, say, you know, driving a car on the freeway.
That's a really good point. We've already seen major issues with driverless cars getting into accidents and the like, not only because they weren't programmed for certain situations, but also that they had to deal with people. And people do unexpected things. In war, though, it's not just that they act in unexpected manners, that you have an adversary. But, you know, we need to be careful here when we're talking about these projects right now and this generation of unmanned systems and AI and the like. We're nowhere near the land of the Terminator or the Matrix or whatever, where the machine is, you know, taking all of its decisions on its own, operating out there on its own. A better way to think about this is sort of the transition of something that's completely remotely operated to maybe something that's a little bit like police dog, where, you know, it's working together with the police officer, but it's, you know, being tasked out, but it's, you know, not supposed to decide who it investigates on its own or even who it bites on its own. Then you get sort of the next level of autonomy and authorization, where a parallel for that might be, say, the game of football, where you have a quarterback and you have wide receivers, and the, you know, quarterback calls a play, the wide receiver carries them out. That may be a similar issue here for the man machine and the robotic wingman that's out there. You know, it's taking on some kind of mission. And just like in football, you know, you might have the play break down, and so they fall back on established alternatives and the like. Then you get to the final stage of this, that it's more like an actual human wingman, where the two are flying together and they have kind of an intuitive understanding of how the other is operating.
When you talk about not really being that close to having this operation, like how far away do you think we really are?
Oh, we are not multiple human generations away from it, but we're not, you know, years. So, you know, I guess the way of thinking about it is each iteration of this is going to get better and better. The more you use it, the more operational it becomes, the more we learn, the more it learns. So, you know, don't expect to see this in the next couple of years on a battlefield near you, but maybe a little bit after that.
What do you think, even in these early stages, that all of this says about both sort of the future of robotics and the future potential of AI and this type of technology for military use?
I think there's two things going on here that are important. The first is the way we think about and talk about artificial intelligence and robotics in both war and civilian life is we tend to kind of fall back on science fiction. What's playing out, though, is not a revolt of the robots, but rather a robotics revolution, kind of like an industrial revolution, where you're seeing this technology used at the tactical level, but it's also causing these larger changes in terms of, you know, overall military doctrine to the kind of skills that you need, whether you're a pilot that's going to be accompanying one of these unmanned systems, or whether you're working as a doctor now, or you're working as a lawyer, or you're working as a factory worker, whatever. So, you know, we have this kind of mass scale of change that's going on. And I think this technology that the Air Force is working on is a good illustration of that. The second thing that's happening is that we see two very different directions with the future of robotics playing out. One is systems like this that are, in essence, mimicking and then replacing the human role. So the vision of it is very much like a robotic version of a human wingman. But there's another change going on with robotics on both civilian and military side, which is where it's not, you know, mimicking it, but rather it's playing out in parallel to something else in nature. It's the idea of swarming, where, you know, like, for example, ants or insects, each little individual is not all that smart, but working together, they can do very complex tasks. And so when you're looking at the future of robotics, again, in war and civilian life, it may not be these big, large systems. It may be lots of teeny tiny ones. The point is that you have these two very different directions of robotics that are happening at the same time.
All right. That's Peter Singer with ASU Center on the Future of War. Peter, good to talk to you. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Good morning. You're listening to the show. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Lauren Gilger. Special hello to listeners at KAWC in Yuma and Parker. Thank you for listening this morning on Colorado River Public Media. College costs continue to climb, making it even more relevant for students to have more knowledge about many things financial, including financial aid, loans, and scholarships. A law recently put into effect in Arizona requires financial education to be included in a high school economics class, an idea pushed forward by lawmakers and Treasurer Kimberly Yee. But should students be learning about personal finance even earlier, and what specifically should they be learning? With me to talk about that is Robert Farrington. He specializes in student loan debt and is the founder of The College Investor, which focuses on millennials. Now, Robert, you believe students should be able to get their first financial learning at home. What should that look like?
So children learn from their role models. And for most children, that's their parents or relatives or, you know, other people they know. And so I think most parents need to be frank with their children about income, expenses, what the family budget looks like, especially by the time they're 12 and getting into middle school. And as they get older, parents need to be transparent about finances when it comes to how much they have saved for college and what the student's responsibility is going to be, what the parent's responsibility is going to be. The earlier you have these conversations, the more transparent families are about money, the better their child's financial success will be in the future.
How difficult have you found that to be for many parents? Even maybe in part, maybe because they're afraid of being transparent. In part, is it possible they don't always understand exactly what they're trying to explain to their kids?
It's both, but I think that's what makes these conversations so beneficial. So if the parents are a little ashamed of their finances or they're not where they want to be, sharing with their children what they're doing about it, the game plan, having their children help them is a huge benefit to opening the child's eyes to seeing what can happen if you're not responsible and what that takes to get out. And then on the flip side, sometimes these conversations are really uncomfortable because families have, you know, taboos around money, or, you know, your parents never spoke to you about it because their parents never spoke to them about it. But you know, they need to be transparent because all you're doing is setting up your child for, you know, financial difficulties down the road.
You know, in the old days, before college cost so much, there used to be the thought of maybe we can put a little bit aside for the college fund and start that at a really young age. Is that even possible these days, considering some universities, the costs are just so sky high?
It is. So I like to view paying for college as a pie, and the pie has lots of slices. So today, the dynamic seems to be, you know, student loans, everyone has to borrow. But, you know, that's just one slice of the pie. There is definitely college savings, and families can start as, you know, young as when the kid is born, and maybe there's birthday money or, you know, other types of gifts that the child gets. And even if that's only a little bit by the time they're 18, at least it's something that you don't have to borrow for. But you also have to remember that the parent is probably working still. So the parents may be able to chip in a little bit as they go. The parents could save money. The child could work in high school and in college. The child can also save. Maybe it's that birthday money again, or maybe it's from earnings from a summer job. And then there's also scholarships, grants, other types of financial aid that all of these pie slices can go into the paying for college equation.
How early should a family, should parents, if they're having that transparent conversation you're talking about, how early should they start planning for, in what ways a student should start looking for financial aid? What options are available? Is that a conversation that should happen before high school?
Yeah, it definitely should be starting about the freshman year of high school, if it's not before. And the reason is that there are scholarships that students can start looking for as early as freshman and sophomore year. And so if parents are thinking that scholarships, especially ones, if they don't think they're going to qualify for need-based, they're going to need those merit scholarships, essays, things like that, maybe volunteer organizations that the student needs to go for, the earlier you have those conversations, the better. But I am so bullish on scholarships right now. I run a scholarship with my business, and they are the most underutilized tool when it comes to paying for college.
So one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you is because here in Arizona, there was a bill passed that is going to require financial education to be included in an economics class. You know, what sort of responsibility do you think there should be in the schools when it comes to government saying, hey, we almost kind of have to force you to learn some of this stuff?
You know, I think it's helpful. Is it going to be the end-all solution? That's to be seen, but I don't think that they're wrong in teaching these practical personal finance skills. And I think we should do it at every age level. I think there should be an elementary school, a middle school, and a high school. You know, even if it's a small part of the curriculum, I think there's a lot of practical value in exposing our students to this because, you know, while we should have transparency at home, like you said, you know, parents don't always have all the right answers. And so maybe if we combine with home life and school, you know, they're getting a better financial footing than they would have without it.
And how much of this is about having a vision for what comes afterwards? When you talk about scholarships as opposed to student loans, when you get out of college, if you can avoid being thousands and thousands of dollars in debt, that can help. But are people aware enough about that? Maybe they look at it too much on the front end, not enough on the back end.
You know, and that's one of the things that you're spot on. I'm trying to reframe the conversation around college as a return on investment. You can go on to the best universities in America today and watch all their college courses for free. So we're not going to college for education these days. We're going to college because we're looking for a structured curriculum that's going to get us higher income statistically than we would have by not going to college. And that to me is as clear of an investment as any other type of investment, whether you're talking real estate or stock market. And so you need to go into that equation knowing what you're going to spend and is it worthwhile? When you get into trouble by overextending yourself, that's when college costs become a real problem. So if we really focus on what is it going to cost and what do I want to do with my life after college, I think we can have a better conversation and we'll see better outcomes as the result of education spending.
Robert Farrington is the founder of The College Investor. Bobeto mangala na o kayo ngavonge ngia o beto mangala na o o mola wenge ngavonge ngia o.
The Tucson City Council and the Pima County Board of Supervisors will vote Tuesday on a new ordinance raising the age to buy nicotine products from 18 to 21 years old. The new law is aimed at preventing teenagers from getting older friends to buy vaping devices and traditional cigarettes. The vote comes as the Trump administration moves to ban all flavored e-cigarettes for sale in the United States. The Centers for Disease Control issued a warning last week about an outbreak of respiratory illnesses caused by vaping. At least 6 people have died, and more than 450 people have been hospitalized related to their use of vaping devices. Joining us now to talk about the proposed ban and the impact of outlawing flavored e-cigarettes as well is Dr. Bob England, Interim Director of the Pima County Department of Health. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Well, I'm great. Thank you for joining us. I want to start with just the this ordinance in Pima County and what the Board of Supervisors is considering. From your perspective, why is this necessary?
This is an attempt to delay the onset of the use of nicotine products by young people, both legitimately for the 18 to 21-year-olds who now can purchase tobacco products. Many of those folks will be addicted and regret that decision just a few years later. So any delay we can get in people beginning to use tobacco and getting hooked on nicotine is a good thing. More importantly, probably, it makes it a lot harder for teenagers to get tobacco products from their older friends.
Right, and this is the same point that the Trump administration is trying to make by banning flavored e-cigarettes. What's your reaction to that announcement this week?
About time. Flavors have been used in e-cigarettes that appeal to very young people. And again, because of the nicotine involved, they then get hooked on those e-cigarettes. And we simply do not know what the long-term consequences of that are going to be. It's one thing, it surprises me that it took this acute outbreak with hundreds of people becoming acutely ill to drive that decision. What worries me much more is the long-term consequences of inhaling this stuff for decades that we will not understand until we get perhaps a whole generation of young people who have COPD in their 30s or 40s. This is a big deal.
So when you're looking at a ban in a county or some of the bans that have been similar in smaller cities or towns, what's the point of doing it piecemeal like that? Like, is there a big enough impact, I guess, in terms of doing it on a local level, or would you like to see this happen statewide or nationwide?
Well, a couple of points. Sure, I would like to see it happen statewide or nationally. It would be a lot better for it to be consistent. Having said that, if you look back at our own history in Arizona of clean indoor air, it took the cumulative pressure over many years of local ordinances beginning to ban smoking indoors for it to catch on to the point where it finally passed at the statewide level.
Yeah.
So we're going to do what we can here in lieu of the state or the feds taking action.
All right. That's Dr. Bob England, Interim Director of the Pima County Department of Health. Dr. England, thank you for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Joanne Hill with the Arizona Game and Fish Department's Community Fishing Program.
Just drop them in.
So what we're doing here at Steele Indian School Park is we just put 80 pounds of rainbow trout into this lake. You're looking at about 150 fish that went into here. These are our big semi-trucks. They're basically aquariums on wheels. So you have to get the net in there, chase them around a little bit. Everything gets wet. Everything gets fishy smelling. They're definitely wriggling in the net when we drop them into the lake. But they're pretty easy to handle. I've been doing this for over 10 years now, so I'm pretty used to it.
That's Joanne Hill with the Arizona Game and Fish Department restocking a lake with rainbow trout. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just wish you could throw us back, send us a note, the show@kjzz.org. And now it's time for the next edition of Sonoran Arcana, our monthly dive into the margins of Arizona food.
This month's Sonoran Arcana is a little different. Phoenix New Times food critic Chris Malloy is serving us his ultimate guide to the ancient and wild foods of the Sonoran Desert. It's sort of an amalgamation of all of the native Arizona foods we've been talking about this year in this series.
We live in a robust desert, as I've discussed before. It has more than 250 species of edible plants, more than 1,000 by some counts. And yeah, this is a guide to some of the major ones. It's not a comprehensive guide. It's more of a gateway into understanding some of these amazing desert ingredients like mesquite and chiltepín and some of the things you may see on menus but not fully understand.
Yeah, okay. So we'll have you walk us through some of your favorites from this ingredient guide. But I want to start with you sitting on a farm in Italy. Tell us about this.
Okay, this is going way back. I spent a summer of my life working on farms in Italy, just kind of pruning in vineyards and harvesting artichokes and doing interesting things like that. The first farm I worked on was just south of Bologna. It was an agritourism run by a former fashion executive who was based in Milan. And he got tired of this kind of corporate life and, you know, just started this place for people to stay on the land and grew grapes. And, you know, we readied the vineyard. We hoed tomato fields. We harvested strawberries. It was an interesting time. But one day after work, we were sitting in the kitchen and he was cooking dinner. It was a matriciana pasta. And we were just sitting around talking about places we wanted to travel to. And for me, they were all pretty remote places, you know, like New Zealand and Hawaii, Southeast Asia. And after I talked about all these places, Federico, the farmer, said more than anything, he wanted to travel to the American Southwest. And for me, being from the Northeast, I was kind of dumbfounded by that. I didn't quite understand. But now that I've lived here and experienced it, I really get it. We live in an amazing part of the world. And people across the world recognize it as amazing. And I think that even within the Southwest, everything that I like about the Southwest and that I think makes it really stand out is almost intensified in the Sonoran Desert. You know, the cacti, the heat, I feel like even the sunsets, like everything feels just so intense and concentrated. And it's such an amazing, alive desert. And I think that people, you know, like where I'm from, the Northeast, perhaps don't fully know about it. And embracing these ingredients and embracing this style of eating, which I think is only going to increase with the coming years, is a way of embracing this amazing biome that we live in.
So why are these ingredients sort of on the margins, as you describe them? Like, less of these are in the mainstream, even in our culinary scene here.
There's a lot here.
Yes.
A lot to unpack.
Yes.
Well, I guess we have to go back to pre-Columbian times. I mean, a lot of these ingredients that the Hohokam used, like mesquite and tapirees, when Western civilization crossed the sea and first came over, new foods and ingredients and concepts were introduced, and the indigenous ingredients and customs and foodways were marginalized. And, you know, that's a process that has kind of continued to the present day. I mean, there are a lot of amazing Sonoran ingredients that were widely used in past centuries that we hardly even know about today. And a lot of people with knowledge of these ingredients are still marginalized and still kind of existing on the culinary fringes of society and the actual fringes too.
So you're trying to remedy that, right? Like, you're trying to bring these back, and that's what this guide is all about.
Yeah.
And like you said, this isn't comprehensive. It's not everything, but it's some of the ones that we've highlighted already in this column that we've talked to you about. And we're going to talk about a few here now that we haven't talked about yet, starting with corn, which seems really obvious, but we actually haven't hit on.
Yeah, corn. I mean, one of the staple ingredients of the pre-Columbian world, the Western Hemisphere, going back to ancient times, it's one of the three sisters together with squash and beans. And there are hundreds and hundreds of kinds of corn. And we've been growing it in these parts for a long time, going back to the Hohokam and before. Yeah, and there's some really interesting kinds of corn being grown around here. I go back to Ramona Farms. They grow four different heirloom varietals, a blue corn, a pink corn, a red corn, and a Pima 60-day corn that, from planting to harvest, is ready in 60 days. And these kinds of corn, you know, grown in our desert, introduce completely different flavors than the kinds of yellow corn you get from your grocery store, which are bred more so for sweetness and visual appeal, so that you grab that corn from the heap of corn and put it in your grocery cart and that kind of thing.
Okay, let's talk about mushrooms, which is not necessarily from the Sonoran Desert, but beyond and here in our region for sure. Tell us about what kinds of mushrooms you find here.
When the late summer hits and foragers aren't really going to the Sonoran quite as much. Mushrooms are plentiful in places like Flagstaff and Prescott. And the kinds of mushrooms you find up there, you find chanterelles, you find what are known as lobster mushrooms, you find tree mushrooms, you find some really interesting stuff. And that makes its way down here, even into restaurants that aren't doing the foraging themselves. And people are doing some great things with wild mushrooms. I talk about Sasha over at 24 Carats, who is foraging lobster mushrooms and turning them into a powder that she'll use in soup stocks and that kind of thing.
Wow.
And to flavor a cheesesteak. It's, yeah, some really interesting stuff going on.
A powder, a mushroom powder. And the mushroom and the harvesting of mushrooms also points to this idea that there are seasons to these things. Like you can gather some things sometimes of year and other things other times.
Yeah, we live in this, you know, modern world of refrigeration and grocery stores and ice cubes. We didn't have that in the desert going back hundreds of years. And the seasons for some of these wild foods are very ephemeral, you know, even just a few days sometimes. Like saguaro fruit, that flashes into season for just a few days.
Right.
Things vary. Things change with rain. The desert springs to life after rain. So you never quite know what you're going to get as you shuffle through the seasons because things are so dependent on rain. And the desert is kind of this interesting master that we can't fully predict.
Okay, and last ingredient we'll probably have time for is a really interesting one, amaranth. This is actually a grain, right?
So amaranth is a grain. It, like corn, pretty widespread in the ancient Western Hemisphere. It is pretty widespread in this area today. I mean, if you walk around Old Town Scottsdale, you can see it growing on sidewalks. I mean, its urban growth is prolific. You can eat both the leaves, which are quick to wilt, but can be used in salads and sauces and that kind of thing. Tamara over at Cotton and Copper is using the greens. She's also using the grains, which are kind of pinpoint and have a nice pop to them, a little bit of a nuttiness. She's using them on just a roasted chicken with a little bit of an amaranth crust.
Mm.
And here's an example of a perfect food that's native to our desert that is underutilized and that has a lot of character, grows all around, and is an amazing ingredient that we overlook.
Okay, so you've been talking about these ingredients and talking to the chefs that are using these for a year now almost in this column, and we've been talking to you about that. But as you put together this guide, this sort of final look at as many of these as you could put together, right? How do you think the culinary scene here would be different if these were not sort of on the margins?
I think it would be a much more interesting place to eat. I mean, it is an interesting place to eat, don't get me wrong. But we have more than 250 edible ingredients in our backyards, and they could introduce some interesting textures, some flavors, some seasonality. And not only in terms of embracing the desert and introducing new flavors, but for the environmentalism as well. I mean, these are ingredients that we're not going out of our way to water. We're not spraying them with pesticides. We're not transporting them across the country in refrigerated trucks or planes. There's a lot to like about embracing the ingredients of the Sonoran Desert, and I think our food scene is going to slowly but surely get into these desert ingredients a little bit more in the coming years. And it's going to be super exciting.
Probably thanks to you. All right. That's Chris Malloy, Phoenix New Times food critic. Chris, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot, Lauren.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.